This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Madeleine Albright is a woman of great accomplishment. She worked as a journalist for the Chicago Sun-Times early in her career, a picture editor for the Encyclopedia Britannica. Later, she would teach at Georgetown University and go on to become U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. But it was when she became the nation's 64th Secretary of State that she truly rose to prominence. Appointed by President Clinton and unanimously confirmed by the U.S. Senate, she was the nation's first female Secretary of State and became the highest-ranking woman in the history of the country. She helped guide the Clinton administration and the nation through some difficult times and more than once spoke her mind forcefully to dictators. It was one of those comments about Saddam Hussein that has indirectly led her to this program today. It was as a result of a comment she made about Hussein that started her habit of wearing decorative pins. Those pins are on display through the end of September at the Mint Museum in an exhibit called Read My Pins, the Madeleine Albright Collection. It features more than 200 pins, many of which Secretary Albright wore to communicate a message or a mood during her diplomatic tenure. She joins us in advance to talk about the pins and much, much more. Secretary Albright, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you, Mike. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was quite an honor to talk to you today. You were already, as I've pointed out, quite an accomplished woman when President Clinton chose you to be his Secretary of State. But still, taking that spot meant all the things I just mentioned. First woman to hold that position, the highest position in the government ever held by a woman to that point in time. Did that ever even cross your mind? Is that the kind of thing that somebody in your position even thinks about?
No, and Mike, this gives me an opportunity. I have to correct something that you said in introducing me because it led directly to answering that question. I never worked for the Chicago Sun-Times.
Oh.
What happened was I had, in fact, worked on a small newspaper in Missouri, and I came to Chicago. My husband had worked for the Sun-Times. And his managing editor looked at me and he said, "So what are you going to do, honey?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to get a job on a newspaper." And there were four papers in Chicago at the time. And he said, "Well, you can't work on the same paper as your husband because of guild regulations. And you wouldn't want to compete with him on another paper, so why don't you find something else to do?" Which is what happened. So I never thought I'd be Secretary of State, obviously. I'd never seen a Secretary of State in a skirt, but I did choose kind of a different career path.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of remarkable when you think about it. I don't know what year that was that conversation you just mentioned took place, but for somebody to sit there and say, "Well, honey, what are you going to do?" And then later on in life, you become the Secretary of State.
Now, I mean, it was 1960, and I can tell you, Mike, I know exactly what I might say today, but instead I just kind of saluted and went on my way. But I think it did turn out okay in the end.
Well, that speaks volumes, actually, about how far we've come, I guess, from at least my point of view. What does it say to you from your point of view?
Well, it does say an awful lot. I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying that to a young woman. I just graduated from Wellesley, and I had made up my, you know, different things, but I did, it says a lot. I think that what women are, the opportunities that are out there are really fantastic, but I also have to tell you, my youngest granddaughter, when she turned 7 2 years ago, said, "So what's the big deal about Grandma Maddie being Secretary of State? Only girls are Secretary of State." So putting those two stories together, I think a lot of changes are out there.
That's very funny. And it's a pretty interesting comment that she made. You know, we hear the media, and I'm guilty of this too, sling around the term Secretary of State. And we don't often give much thought to the relative importance, I think, of that position. The Secretary of State is the highest ranking cabinet official and a person who is in the line of succession to the president. Would it be fair to say that in our system of government, Secretary of State could be considered the person in charge of the nation's foreign policy, at least the face of the nation's foreign policy, the international president of the United States?
Yes, absolutely. And it is an amazing job. It is the senior one. I loved the idea that I had Thomas Jefferson's job. And it is the face of America. And what Secretary Clinton is proving that every hour as she travels around the world, and I think it is a great honor to to represent the United States. One thing that was different about me, I was born, I wasn't born in the United States. I was born in Czechoslovakia. So I was taken out of the line of succession as a personal person. And I think it made me sense even more so the great honor of sitting behind a sign that said United States. It is something that is an unparalleled honor because you are the face of this amazing country.
Yeah, only, I guess, natural-born citizens can be president, and therefore if you came here from another country, although you can serve the country, you can't be the president.
That's right.
And if you're the Secretary of State and something happens to the president, I guess they had to make allowances for not allowing you to hold that position, which... So it seems somewhat unfair, actually, when you come right down to it. Did it seem that way to you?
Well, I obviously not only thought about what it meant, but I get asked about it a lot. And I think it was done originally because they were concerned Alexander Hamilton was not born in the United States. And so there were various political reasons. Mm. What is interesting, Senator Hatch has talked about, you know, shouldn't there be some other way of deciding, and I've thought often that if you've lived in the United States for X number of years and have had an American education, that maybe something should be changed. I do think having an American education makes a big difference in terms of what you learn about civics and how our government works and human rights and various aspects. But so many people are immigrants, and this country, I think, has been enriched by immigrants. But we know how hard it is to get some kind of an amendment to the Constitution.
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, our guest today. She'll be in Charlotte tomorrow at 1 o'clock at the Mint Museum to speak about her pin collection, which we'll also talk about later in the hour, which is on display at the Mint and has been for several months and will be there till the end of September. Can we talk about how foreign policy is developed? I mean, how much say does the Secretary of State have in developing and or finalizing that policy versus the president?
You will be so sorry you asked me this, because this is what I teach about now. I think what is interesting is that there are certain national interests that America has that are classic in terms of who our allies are, what we want to see in the world, and what is really the best example of what is good for the American people. So those are the kind of basic aspects. The State Department is the agency which, in fact, has all the people that are experts on various parts of foreign policy. But the president is the ultimate decision maker for the United States. And so a system is set up through the National Security Council. And it was actually set up as a revenge against the way President Roosevelt made decisions, which was pitting people against each other and a little bit disorganized. So the NSC system brings together the principals, that is, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the President, the Vice President, and then whomever the President decides, in order to kind of set the issues up for the President. And that is how the policy evolves. The president is the decision maker, and the secretaries then carry out the decisions.
We've had discussions on this program about America's form of government and how it was set up to be quite deliberative and slow by the founding fathers. And in an age of Twitter and Facebook and social media and international 24-hour news cycles, that sometimes, it seems, puts us at a slight disadvantage, it seems to me. Because in America, our foreign policy could literally change every 4 years if the president only serves one term. Does that hurt us, or does that help us?
Well, there's a whole other part to foreign policy, and obviously Congress has a role in it. And the way that the Constitution is written, it is often called an invitation to struggle, because Congress does, in fact, appropriate the money for the foreign policy. They also, you know, there are foreign relations and foreign affairs committees in Congress, and there are the whole issues about who declares war, what the role of the commander-in-chief is, and then as we've recently heard about the Commerce Clause, that is something that gives an awful lot of power to Congress in terms of doing foreign policy. So it is slow, and that's the confusion, and I do think that foreign countries are definitely confused about the fact that the executive branch might in fact be negotiating a treaty, but then it has to be, advice and consent has to be given by the Senate, and so that takes a long time. So there is confusion.
Mm-hmm.
I do think in terms of does it change every 4 years, there are changes, but basically that first point that I made about what is national interest and what our values are does not change and should not change. But every administration comes in with different priorities.
But how would you characterize the change in our foreign policy from when you came in, from the Bush administration, Bush 1, and how it changed when George W. Bush and Secretary Powell took over your job when the Bush administration, number 2, started?
Well, I think that, and this is a very important point, is that issues actually do not change, and so no administration comes in with a clean slate. You have to pick up the issues that are out there, and that is the responsibility. I mean, you are representing the United States. You don't represent a particular party, and I really think that when you walk into those offices, you do have that feeling. You've just been given the crown jewels, and you do have to carry out your responsibility representing the president and the United States and creating policy in that way.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in the Bush administration, Bush 1, and I think it's interesting because you've already mentioned this a little bit. We came in with the Clinton administration in 93, and the big issue out there was that President Bush had the Gulf War. And the Gulf War had ended, and what happened was that the ceasefire was translated into 6 sanctions resolutions, and that's what I was sent. One of the things that I had to do in New York was to make sure those sanctions resolutions stayed on. The other thing that was out there that had to be picked up was the whole issue with Somalia that had started out as a humanitarian operation and then developed into what was one of the more difficult foreign policy issues that we had. And I think there probably were fewer real changes from Bush 1 to Clinton than there were from Clinton to Bush 2.
Hmm.
Because what's interesting is the first President Bush actually understood, I think, the importance of multilateral action. The coalition that went after, you know, did the Gulf War was something that came out of the United Nations. President Clinton really believed in partnership. It was wonderful to be his ambassador to the UN in terms of how we thought we could use the UN in a very, I don't want to overdo this in terms of being simplistic, but the second President Bush was a unilateralist. And there were real differences in terms of the way that the Bush administration looked at a variety of issues. And one that I am particularly troubled by is I am still the highest level sitting American official to have gone to North Korea to meet with Kim Jong-il about the nuclear issues.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the middle of really serious discussions when the election of 2000 happened. A lot of Americans were confused about that election. Kim Jong-il certainly was. And what happened was the Bush administration, Bush 2, never picked up the hand of cards for that.
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break. Maybe we'll pick it up on the other side because it's pretty interesting, that North Korea situation. Madeline Albright, our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tile Collection, a family-owned business offering kitchen, patio, and bath makeovers in Charlotte since 1992. Showroom located across from Carolina Place Mall in Pineville or online at tilecollection.com. Coming up on Monday on this program, the DNC is almost upon us and vendors are gearing up all over the region to serve the thousands of convention attendees expected to arrive. But what about small businesses that dot the areas near Uptown? Many say they don't know how to gain the attention of visitors, so one business owner came up with a novel idea. She decided to stalk Comedy Central personality Jon Stewart of The Daily Show. We'll hear her story and then meet a young man who attended a school he says not enough young people know about and one that changed his life. Those stories and more on Charlotte Talks Monday at 9. We'll get back to this rebroadcast in just a moment.
Mm-hmm. On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Each week we offer analysis of national news with a panel of top journalists. Whether you listen for 5 minutes or an hour, you'll come away with a deeper understanding of what's happening in the world. Join us for the Friday News Roundup.
That's the Diane Rehm Show right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on your NPR news source, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Secretary of State Madeleine Albright under the Clinton administration, who will be in town tomorrow at 1 to speak at the Mint Museum about her collection of pins, which is in residence there until the end of September. It's called Read My Pins, the Madeleine Albright Collection. There's a companion book to that, which is wonderful, by the way, because you really get to see up close and personal some of the pins that you've seen in all these television shows and magazine and newspaper shots, because she's always wearing a pin. Are you wearing one right now, by the way?
I will be. I am going to wear. I got a beautiful dogwood blossom, so that seems to make sense. And then I have one of those little Charlotte crowns.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about these pins in a second here. Let's go back to North Korea for a moment, because I know that I think I saw you on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He was asking you about various world leaders, and Kim Jong-il came up. And I believe at the time Kim Jong-il was still alive. And he said, what are your impressions of him? And I think you said, he's nuts.
No, I mean, he was really weird. I mean, the bottom line is we had very little information about him. And I had obviously done a lot of work before I went there, and the president of South Korea, Kim Dae-jung, at the time, had said to me, he's not crazy, because you can really talk to him, but he's very, very peculiar. And what happened was that I wasn't sure I was going to be able to see him, and when first I was ordered to go and see his embalmed father, which I was kind of strange, and then the minute I had done that, we were able to have a press conference. So I had it. We're standing there together, and I saw that we were about the same height, and I knew I had on high heels. And then I looked at him, and so did he. And his hair was a lot poofier than mine, and he just was very, very peculiar person. And obviously, you know, when you've been told from childhood that you are semi-divine, it affects him. But what was interesting was that we did have, I think, very, very substantive negotiations. And while I hold no brief for the North Koreans, and the people there are eating bark off the trees and terrible things, I do think that it was a mistake by the Bush administration not to continue the negotiations that we had begun.
Can we talk about North Korea in some depth here? I know we don't know much about that country, but you've been there. You met Kim Jong-il. Have you met his son, Kim Jong-un?
No, I don't know.
And what we know of the society there, it's criminal what's going on over there. As you say, they're eating tree bark, and they're starving in that part of the world. And they think, at least we're told that the people think, that they are at threat from the outside world and that they live better than people in the outside world. How can that be in this day and age? And
well,
why doesn't the United States do something about that?
Amazing book out now, which
yes.
is called Escape from Camp 14. I'm just reading it. And it is really important in terms of understanding what can be done to human beings if they are completely isolated and fed facts that make no sense at all and are separated from any kind of human contact. I mean, it's pathetic. It's a horrible, horrible story. What I think is beginning to happen because of the penetration of social media and information, some information is coming in. The issue for them is that they are only interested in the survival of not just the state, but the Kim family, which is kind of a communist dynasty. But ultimately, I believe that there's no way anymore to completely seal down a country. But that's the problem. They have no alternative source of information.
But had the Clinton administration gone on, say, for another 4 years, and you'd come to some sort of agreement with Kim Jong-il, or had the Bush administration picked up where you left off, would life for those people be better today, or were your negotiations involved in that aspect of life in North Korea at all?
No, it was not. I mean, these were talks that were basically over their nuclear potential and whatever military capability they had of missiles or invading South Korea. What did happen, and so it moves in the question that you asked, is the United States and other countries have in fact contributed to the World Food Program in order to make sure that the people can eat during times of complete bad droughts and various problems that they have. And they do have an energy problem. There's no question about it. I mean, they don't have oil. Their cash crop is export of nuclear technology. So they are a very peculiar economy. I think that, and what does happen, is when there's a complete breakdown in the talks, or we find that they're lying to us, because they do that, then the World Food Program is cut off. But one of the things that was going on, the president of South Korea, Kim Dae-jung, had a very interesting policy he called the Sunshine Policy. And the purpose of it was ultimately to have a unified Korean Peninsula, but it did allow for the possibility of zones where there could be trading and the development of jobs, which would answer the question. You know, we were looking towards a period when there would improve the situation for the North Koreans.
When East Germany was reunited with West Germany, they went through a very uncomfortable period because people in the East were not as economically as wealthy as people in the West, and they had all kinds of years of struggle with the communist regime that left them well behind their fellow citizens in the West. What would happen with a unified Korea? What would happen with the people in the North? It seems to me that not only have they been deprived, but they've been psychologically battered. Could they function in the modern world?
Well, that is, first of all, what is very interesting, when you talk to South Koreans, they do now see what happened with the unification of Germany. I mean, there was the glorious kind of euphoric moment when the wall came down, and then exactly the kind of problems you were talking about, but in no way comparable to what might happen in a unified Korean peninsula. So that is an issue, very much an issue. And so there are divisions within South Korea as to who actually wants just to have good relations. Part of the problem is that there are a lot of North Koreans who, the Koreans are one people, and so there have been families that have been separated and various ways that they want to be together. But there are real issues, and once you read this book and then others, you just don't see how they can, you know, exactly the things you're talking about in terms of the brainwashing and the tragedy. And so I do not foresee a unification. I do hope that at some point the relationships get better, and we do have to get control over whatever it is they're doing in the nuclear field, because part of the problem, Mike, is they did lie. There's just no question about that. So there can't be any agreements that are not completely verifiable.
Before we move to your pins, I have a listener question. Lou on Facebook's writing in. In your experience, they want to know who has the most respected mind in Washington or in the world. Who do you think is the best mind?
The best mind?
Mm-hmm.
I actually do believe President Obama. I think he has a remarkable mind in terms of the process by which he makes decisions, the information that he wants to have in order to make a decision, his background, his capabilities in analyzing and making decisions. I really do believe that.
I know that you're a Democrat. I know that you supported Hillary Clinton for president in 2008 up to a point. I suppose when Obama took became the obvious nominee, you switched your allegiance, as most Democrats did. How would you compare the two minds? Hillary's, because I've seen Hillary Clinton speak extemporaneously for 45 minutes on a very difficult subject, and she is amazing.
I think she is amazing, and I think it probably would have been too obvious as if I said that she had the best mind. I mean, We went to the same college, so I know exactly about her study habits at Wellesley. Mm-hmm. She's 10 years younger than I am. She has a huge capability to absorb information. And I think she also has that talent. You know what? I wrote a book called Memo to the President-elect at a time when I had no idea who that president was going to be. And I said that what I wanted in a president was somebody that was confident and not certain. Because if you are certain, you don't even know what you don't know, and you don't want to hear a lot of different opinions. If you're confident, you have the capability of eliciting opinions from others and then making up your mind. I think that both Secretary Clinton and President Obama have that capability. I think she is a very, very natural politician, and I like the word politician, by the way. I think she has an amazing capability of of having a narrative about what she says, and then the capability of handling people in a very natural way. Mm-hmm. And so they have a different style. But I think that desire to absorb information and respect other people's opinions is something that they share.
How big a role did you play in Hillary Clinton's acceptance of Barack Obama's offer to be Secretary of State?
I mean, we're friends, obviously, and we talked. But, you know, she did something that I think is important to talk about in terms of the capability of people working together. And I have to tell this story. I created something called the Community of Democracies, which it was about 12 years ago now, which were countries all over the world that were supposed to share best practices, et cetera, and work together. And we had the commemoration of it, the 10th anniversary in Poland, and there were representatives of over 100 countries there. And Secretary Clinton came to speak, and she gave a very good speech, and then she went off script of any kind, and she said the following thing. She said, everybody knows that I ran against Senator Obama, and he beat me fair and square. And then he called me up and asked whether I'd be Secretary of State, and I thought about it for a while, and I decided that I needed to have a partnership and work together. That was the amazing lesson for the representatives of other democracies. Hmm. And that is the way she has seen it. And I think she's been a remarkable Secretary of State. And just this last trip that she's taking, I mean, she has just been in Asia. She has, and this is the important thing, is she has given a lot of flesh to the bones in terms of the administration decision to pay more attention to Asia, so it's not just a military thing, but going around and talking about the whole South China Sea issue, about human rights, women's rights, development, the economy. So she is just a brilliant partner to President Obama.
Why do you think, I think the decision has been made, I could be wrong about this, for her not to serve as Secretary of State should there be a second term? Is that true? And if so, why would she not go on?
Well, she said it some time ago, and I don't know the answer. I mean, I think that she has been in public service for a very long time, and she feels that, the things that she said publicly is that basically she has been First Lady, Senator, now Secretary of State, and it's her personal decision.
Mm-hmm. We know that the job of president is a 24/7, four-year job. Is the job of Secretary of State similar?
Absolutely. No question. And I don't think people focus on the fact that in many ways, the travel part of the Secretary of State is more onerous or time-consuming than for president. Because to go back to one of the early questions you asked me, the Secretary of State is the face of the United States. Mm-hmm. And it is important to go to a country, because then you can work on the phone or through email. But it is important to have that contact. And so the travel, you know, around the world in different time zones and being able to be functional after 4 hours of sleep, I think, is something that makes the job for, I think, fantastically interesting, but also difficult.
And that leads nicely into why you're coming to Charlotte for the Read My Pins exhibit, because you have this, you developed this habit of choosing pins to wear to communicate an idea or a mood or a thought process to people that you were meeting with and in countries that you went to. And one of the jobs, I suppose, of Secretary of State is to speak power to truth, which you have done on more than one occasion. And that first occasion, I guess, was when you said something about Saddam Hussein. And that is what led to your, I'm told, what led to
right.
your
yep.
now famous habit of wearing these pins. So talk about that. What's the story behind that?
Well, I mean, you started a little bit, but what happened was, as I said, when I went to the UN, which was in February 93, it was in order to offer to represent our country, but to deal to a great extent with the follow-through on the Gulf War. And what had happened was, as I said, the ceasefire had been translated into a series of sanctions resolutions, and I was an instructed ambassador, and my instructions were to make sure that those sanctions stayed on. And so, in order to do that, I said perfectly horrible things about Saddam Hussein constantly, which he deserved. He'd invaded Kuwait. And so all of a sudden a poem appeared in the papers in Baghdad comparing me to many things, but among them an unparalleled serpent. And I happened to have had a snake pin, so I decided to wear it when we were talking about Iraq. And I think you know how after various meetings the ambassadors go out and they talk to the press, and all of a sudden a camera zeroes in on my snake pin and says, so why are you wearing that snake pin? And I said, because Saddam Hussein compared me to an unparalleled serpent. And then I thought, well, this is fun. So I went out and I bought a lot of costume jewelry to kind of reflect what I thought was going to happen on any day. And it was right after the first President Bush had said, read my lips. And so when somebody said, I said, read my pins. And that's how it started. And it really, what was interesting was that the people watching me and the other ambassadors, they began to get it, you know. So on days that I wore bees or some kind of carnivorous animal, they knew that we had a difficult problem. And on balloons and flowers and butterfly days, things were good. And so it was fun. And the reason that I thought that the pin collection would be fun to do is I clearly love foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And I think that I wanted to show that foreign policy doesn't have to be so foreign, and that here I was the only woman on the Security Council, not the first woman, by the way, to go to the UN. Jean Kirkpatrick had done
right.
that. But I had fun with it, and it did kind of, you know, break the ice, and it was very funny, actually.
I'm going to quote from this poem that you said appeared as a result of your comments about Saddam Hussein. It was by Saddam Hussein's poet in residence. I find it surprising that he had a poet in residence. But the poem goes something along the lines of, Albright, Albright, all right, all right, you are the worst in this night. Albright, no one can block the road to Jerusalem with a frigate, a ghost, or an elephant. And then he compares you to an unmatched clamor maker and unparalleled serpent, which I suppose rhymes with elephant. If it's a stretch, I suppose it's a stretch there, which proves that beyond a shadow of a doubt that this guy wasn't much of a poet.
Well, it may sound better in Arabic.
Maybe it might do that. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about Read My Pins with Secretary Madeleine Albright. Stay with the Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center. Uncorked, a North Carolina wine tasting with live music by Humming House, Danger Muffin, and the Tone Blazers, tomorrow starting at 1 p.m. usnwc.org. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, it's Friday. That means the news roundup. Domestic news in hour one. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney accused President Barack Obama of dismantling federal welfare reform and creating a culture of dependency. The U.S. economy continued to send mixed signals, and victims of the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting were remembered at vigils across the United States. Those stories and more coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. We'll get back to our conversation with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in just a moment. This is a rebroadcast edition of the show, so we won't be able to take your phone calls this morning.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball, host of America's Test Kitchen, heard Sundays at 3 p.m. on 90.7 WFAE. Our program is filled with clear, practical information and techniques that illuminate the truth about real home cooking. There'll be some mystery, too, like why bad things happen to good recipes and the science behind good results. Join us this Sunday at 3 p.m. for America's Test Kitchen on listener-supported radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State, our guest today. She's in town tomorrow at 1 o'clock to speak at the Mint Museum. It's sold out in the main auditorium, but there is a satellite viewing location for which tickets are available, and you can go to their website or ours for information about that. She'll also be having a private signing of her book, Read My Pins, which goes along with the exhibit, Read My Pins, which runs through September 30th at the Mint Museum. And we have some of the photographs of these pins on our website right now if you want to take a look at them at WFAE.org. Can you tell us about one or two of your favorite pins in this long-running collection?
Well, I have different ones. I mean, one that I really love is a heart, a ceramic heart. And my daughter made it, and so people, you know, say, well, how old is your daughter? And she's obviously, now she's 45. And so she says, Mom, you have to tell people that I was 5 when I made this pin. But it is kind of symbolic in terms of the kind of emotion that pins can carry. And then one that is at the end of the book, and since it's not a mystery story, I can tell you what it is I had gone down to New Orleans a couple of years after Katrina and went to the D-Day Museum, and then there was a dinner with a variety of people, but among them veterans, and all of a sudden this young man comes over and he says, my father over there was a veteran of World War II, and he earned Purple Hearts, and our family loved you, and he had this box, and said, our mother died as a result of Katrina, and we want you to have this pin that my father gave her for his 60th wedding anniversary. And I opened the box, and it's this amazing pin with two amethysts, which must have signified the Purple Hearts, and I said, I can't possibly accept this. He said, you must, because it would honor us. And so the Katrina pin is one of my really favorite pins.
This is the one that's surrounded by, I guess they're diamonds or...
Yeah, it's quite a spectacular pin. And,
it really is.
But again, it shows how some inanimate object can convey emotion.
And yet many of these you went shopping for, which actually surprised me, because I was going to ask you about... how you acquired these pins. When does the Secretary of State or a U.N. Secretary, ambassador to the U.N., rather, have a chance to go out and shop for these pins, some of which must have, you've had to think about it because they have meaning. They send a message.
Well, I tell you, I mean, mostly it's accidental, and I do a little retail therapy. And but you're going to think I'm crazy. I mean, what happens is I have gone to flea markets. I mean, or when I've traveled abroad to the souk, something just kind of strikes my eye, mm-hmm. and I think it's really fun, and it fits into a story, you know. So, but for instance, pins have gotten me into trouble. One of the things that happened was that there's this great picture of President Clinton, Bill Cohen, and me sitting on a sofa doing the Hear No Evil, See No Evil monkeys. And I was actually in Brussels, and all of a sudden I see these great pins that are three monkeys. So I had to buy that. And then when we went to Moscow, I thought that President Putin's Chechen policy was evil. So I wore the three monkeys. And... it was quite an incident because he said to President Clinton, we always watch what pin Secretary Albright wears. Why are you wearing those three monkeys? And I said, because of your Chechnya policy. And he got furious at me. And President Clinton looked at me like, are you out of your mind? You have just screwed up the entire summit. But I had thought it through a little bit.
So you actually have to think and pack proper pin. So talk to me about Vladimir Putin for a second, because, you know, he came from the KGB. He's led that country on and off for an enormous amount of time. He seems to be, to Western eyes, I guess, to be somewhat suspect in terms of his control over that country and how much democracy he will actually let them have. Yet George W. Bush looked into his eyes and saw a good guy. Give me your take on him.
Well, it's very interesting. President Clinton and I first met Vladimir Putin when he was still kind of the acting president, and was a meeting of APEC, the Asian American kind of trading association. And at that stage, Putin seemed very kind of small and pale and trying very hard to ingratiate himself. And then later, when he became president and we were at this particular summit, the feeling that one, I've done an awful lot of reading about him, and so had President Clinton. And basically, Putin is very smart and sharp. And I think he is a KGB, this is my personal opinion. I think that he is somebody who has a mentality of the KGB and is surrounded by a lot of people that have the same background that he does. I mean, they're called Siloviki, and I think, so there's that part. The other part is that he is bound and determined to restore Russia's identity, which you can't blame a national leader for that. I mean, we had a job that I don't think's ever been asked of before, is how to kind of lower the capabilities of your chief adversary without, making them feel that they no longer have a role. And so we worked very hard on that. But Putin is a very self-absorbed person and somebody who wants to have total control and has grown into that role and thinks that he is Russia.
You said that you felt that his Chechenian policy was evil, and George W. Bush talked about the axis of evil. When the two of you use the word evil, is it defined the same way?
Probably not, And let me go back on something. It is beyond my understanding about how anybody could have looked into Putin's eyes and trusted him. I mean, I thought the reason that the Chechnya policy was evil was that people were just being slaughtered mm-hmm. for not anything that they had done, but for who they were. I actually think that the discussion of axis of evil was one of the damaging aspects, because it put three countries together that shouldn't have been put together, and the wrong lessons were learned. And the lesson was that if you don't have nuclear weapons, you get invaded, and if you do have nuclear weapons, you don't. So Iraq gets invaded, Iran and North Korea, there's a different aspect about it. And I think the evil, I don't know what President Bush's definition of evil was.
You have said that the war in Iraq, this country's invasion of Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein, was this country's biggest mistake, and that we are still being hurt because of it. Why?
Well, first of all, I think, and I fully agreed with what President Bush did in response to 9/11. The people who hit us came from Afghanistan, and it was totally appropriate to take the action that we did. What I think went wrong here is that President Bush and his people, primarily Vice President Cheney, when we were talking about how foreign policy was made, mm-hmm. using a undisclosed parallel track to the system, decided to use the pivoted from Afghanistan to Iraq. And I did believe that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. That was what we were doing at the United Nations, was inspecting, limiting him. I just did not think that he was a threat to the United States. We had him in a box. And so what the Bush people did was to take their eye off Afghanistan and then move it into Iraq, and at the same time, I think, did not have a plan of how this was going to end, and created huge animosity towards the United States, and did something that I think is unpardonable, and that is militarized democracy. You cannot impose democracy. That is an oxymoron. And so the kind of unintended consequences of Iraq are we will continue to pay for.
Is that, in your mind, why we should not intervene in Syria? Because even though those people want out under the thumb of, I can't think of his name now.
Assad.
We shouldn't go in because you can't militarize democracy. You can't force that on a people?
No, I mean different things. That's a very difficult question. I think that, people compare what is going on in Syria to what happened in Libya or what happened in Bosnia. I think that I believe that the United States has to do everything we can to make sure that people are able in their own countries to live in a way that respects their dignity and they have a chance to work and everything, choose what they want to do. I don't think we can intervene everywhere. I think what has to happen is that the specific situation has to be looked at very carefully and try to figure out what tools foreign policy has to affect change so that people can make their own decisions.
Do you know Assad?
Yes, I do, actually.
And what's your impression of him?
Well, I met him a long time ago. Mm-hmm. What happened was that I represented the United States at his father's funeral. Mm. And I met him the first time then. And the pitch on him, given to me very deliberately, was that he was this very intelligent young man who had decided that he wanted to be an ophthalmologist so that he could look into people's eyes and that he was Western oriented. And I met him several times, and my feeling about him was that I've said this is one and one made two, but two and two didn't make four. I mean, there's something, but he has obviously changed. I mean, that was like 11 years ago. He is now surrounded by people that are dependent on him and has, I think, become completely isolated from what reality is, what's going on.
Let me share some questions that have come in from people listening. Pebbles on our website says, it was so sad to read last week about the arrests in Burma. What do you see in Burma's future, and what pin would you wear there?
Well, I went to Burma in 1995 and met Aung San Suu Kyi, and I think that it's a better situation than it was. I mean, she is a remarkable person who is pushing in terms of the agenda that she has for the country, which is to have democracy and have choice. And I think that there have been advances. The fact that there were elections that took place, a lot of political activists were released. But it is not a straight line here. I think that one of the things that's interesting is the United States has now suspended certain sanctions that have been on Burma. And I underline the word suspended because it means that if things are not going in the right direction, there's leverage there to reimpose certain ones, or we're not certainly not giving them a clean slate of any kind. And we now have an ambassador there, somebody who is very familiar with Burma. And so I think we have to keep our eye on it. What I would probably do, and I actually Aung San Suu Kyi and I have exchanged pins in an interesting way. She sent me this wonderful bird that is a Burmese symbol. But I might wear my dogwood pin that I'm going to wear to Charlotte because Aung San Suu Kyi always has flowers in her hair.
That's true. Brent on Facebook writes, what pin would be appropriate for Secretary Clinton to wear in getting Assad to step down, a tank or F-16? Maybe she has a better one.
I don't know. I mean, what she's trying to do, she probably would have to wear the whole host of tools that we have, you know, some talking, some sanctions, some threats, etc. It would be quite an array.
John on Facebook wants to know, should or would Condoleezza Rice run on the ticket with Mitt Romney?
Well, I have no idea. You know, I think I was just seeing that she is now part of the Veep Sweat Stakes that they're talking about her. She's a very capable person and a good friend of mine.
Okay. Is it difficult to be good friends with somebody in the opposite party when you get to your level in Washington?
Interesting enough, not. What the group of the former secretaries of state get together, and I am now the only former Democratic secretary of state because Secretary Christopher died, and what we have found is the people that have the high-level jobs, I think, understand how difficult they are. And I talk to Secretary General Powell frequently, and Jim Baker and Secretary Kissinger and George Shultz and I just appeared together. And I also have a number of Republican friends that I worked with before. And I know this is probably hard to believe, but as Secretary of State, I developed a way and a partnership with Jesse Helms. We did not agree on some very basic things, but we certainly managed to get work done.
You're a longtime diplomat, so what could the parties and the leaders of the parties, who seem to be in perpetual gridlock now, learn from spending a year or two in the diplomatic corps?
Well, I think, diplomats, the job of a diplomat is to represent your country and be the eyes and ears and make very clear what the message of the country is. But to negotiate and to be a successful negotiator, you have to put yourself into the other person's shoes. It's the only thing you can do is to understand that it has to be a win-win. And it depends on what the definition is, but somebody wants something in a deal, and without giving away your basic value system, that's what negotiations are about.
Jim in Fort Mill wants to know how to get a particular pin to you, and we will forward this email on to your people so that you can work this out.
Oh, I can't wait.
Okay.
That's great.
Because it's the Glinda's wand, because as Secretary of State, you know better than most, he says that there is no place like home.
I love that. Thank you.
Madeleine Albright will be here in Charlotte tomorrow at 1 to speak and sign her book, Read My Pins, at the Mint Museum. Thank you very much for the hour.
Well, Mike, thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.6.